Hello and welcome to SIPFA Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. SIPFA recently released two reports focused on sustainability, so to celebrate that, we'll be discussing sustainability on today's special episode. First up, SIPFA's chief economist Jeffrey Matsu and Nina Johansson, SIPFA's sustainability advisor, both discuss SIPFA's recent sustainability reports. We'll also hear from Jonathan Woods, who is a newly qualified accountant from Cambridgeshire County Council. And lastly, we're joined by Peter Eckersley, who is a senior research fellow at Nottingham Trent University. Up first, it's Nina Johansson and Jeffrey Matsu.
Hi, Jeff and Nina. Thanks for being on SIPFA Speaks. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Thanks so much, Chantal. And hi, everyone. My name is Nina Johansson, and I am SIPFA's sustainability advisor. As for my background, it spans both the policy and the operational space. Before joining SIPFA, I held roles in a number of certification bodies and consultancies that were operating in the sustainability space. And I've also worked for quite a few years in the corporate social responsibility and supply chain consulting space, primarily around audit and human rights. Previously, I spent 7 years as a local politician in my native country of Sweden, where I served on the Environmental Committee. And in this position, I was part of the cross-party coalition group that was responsible for the strategic and long-term environmental work in the city of Malmö. It's a real pleasure to be here today, talking about this very important burning topic area.
Hi, my name is Jeff Matsu. I'm the chief economist at SIPFA, and my role primarily is working with policymakers at both a national and local government level to address issues of the day. Today, we'll be discussing sustainability, but I work across various themes and partner with a lot of academics to bring fresh evidence, mainly in the form of data and insights, to inform how government makes policies effectively using taxpayer funds.
Thank you. So this episode is all about sustainability, a topic that's only going to get more and more important. SIPFA's recently released two major reports, one that focuses on sustainability reporting in the public sector, and then the other one on carbon pricing. Could you both tell us a little bit more about them and how they came to be?
Yes, absolutely. So in June 2021, we set out to identify what international public sector organizations were actually doing to understand and to report on their climate impact. And we surveyed a number of public sector professionals from all around the world and published the results of these findings in our report, Evolving Climate Accountability, a Global Review of Public Sector Environmental Reporting. And this report, it found that while public sector sustainability reporting, it was indeed lagging behind the private sector, there was still an appetite for action. So as a next step, we wanted to look at how to best move forward. And we did this by producing the report that we launched only last week, Public Sector Sustainability Reporting, Time to Step It Up. So there are a multitude of guidelines and requirements that have been developed for specific organizations, for subsectors within the public sector, and also for different local government areas and states, even within the same country. And this is, of course, not very efficient. So the recently launched report, it aims to provide answers and positive steps to addressing the most pressing challenges around public sector sustainability questions. And it's meant to provide the necessary historical context of the reporting space, as well as give the reader a view of the here and the now. Because time really is of the essence, and it is indeed time for the public sector to step up and to lead from the front when it comes to disclosing sustainability impacts. And by using already existing standards that, of course, align with the public sector's unique needs, we are hoping that this report will provide public finance professionals with a really good understanding of what kind of information actually needs to go into the report, what needs to be disclosed, and also the process in producing a really high quality report.
Thank you. Jeff, did you want to expand on that?
Yes, thanks, Chantelle. The reason we decided to focus on how public financial management can engage with global themes such as carbon pricing is because oftentimes we find that public finances really don't play a leading voice in global conversations such as this. You tend to have politicians, economists, people from scientists, but very seldom do you find accountancy at the table when we're talking about how to improve things like the environment. And so we thought that our contribution would be to see how public financial management can play a greater role in addressing topical issues such as this one. Having said that, we find that our profession can be most more effective when we engage with other disciplines. And so through this piece of work, we were able to interview and discuss ideas with what other professions are doing. We've also kind of looked to the literature in terms of academia, into data sets to see how improvements can be most effectively put into place. Finally, I would say that it's really important for us when we talk about carbon pricing to understand the practicalities of what practitioners on the ground are facing. And these practitioners tend to mainly be in local government. So in the councils and local authorities that pretty much shape the lives that we see in our own communities, whether it's here in the UK or overseas. And a lot of the policy frameworks that countries such as the UK commit to, for example, the Sustainable Development Goals, we need to find clearer ways of percolating actions down to the local level. And hopefully this report achieves some of that.
Thank you. So following on from that, I think you guys have kind of answered this next question, but both reports emphasize that the public sector should be leading on climate change. Why is the public sector best placed to take the lead? And are there any barriers stopping it?
The public sector, it's often the biggest economic driver in developed nations. And because of this, it's also more likely to have a large environmental impact. And that's through things like healthcare services, waste collection, the armed forces, and other types of public services and beyond. And it doesn't only produce its own carbon footprint through these vital services, but it also sets the standards and the targets for the private sector's emissions and impact. And as a whole, the objectives of public sector organizations, they are fundamentally linked to public interest and benefits. So there are really strong incentives that the sector as a whole report and account for their impact. In fact, taxpayers and citizens, they increasingly demand it. They want to know how public sector organizations are actually addressing sustainability challenges. And throughout this process, building and maintaining trust is absolutely fundamental, because every day decisions are made by government on all levels that have a direct impact on a wide array of stakeholders. And these decisions, they're not based on financial information alone. They are centered around risk and opportunities that are related to a variety of short and long-term factors. And sustainability topics are increasingly integrated into these types of processes. And as priorities have changed around the world, the climate crisis, it now finds itself at the top of the global agenda, with public interest running at an all-time high. And the truth is that the public sector, it exists to serve the needs of the public interest. So it should stride ahead. It should lead the way on the road to a more sustainable everyday for everyone.
Thank you. Jeff, did you have anything that you wanted to follow up on from Nina's point, or should I move on to the next question?
You know, I would thank Chantelle. I would say that the public sector can certainly be a partner in climate change, because the private sector to date has really taken the lead. I think the public sector really needs to step up its game and become more of an equal partner in tackling this global challenge. And we know that policymakers will need to better associate the outcomes of climate change with people's everyday lives and shared values. And that is something that policymakers are, and politicians more generally, are well-placed to deliver. Local leaders in particular are well-placed to frame policy options in terms of localized interests and risks. And carbon pricing principles more broadly can inform policy and spending decisions based on impact visibility. And that is something where we really need to make more of an effort of making sure that people in local communities can see how some of these fiscal interventions are translating into action. It's not always clear, and I think we really need to make some of this more visible in a practical way that can be digested by people, by everyday people in society. Local authorities in particular have been found to be able to influence a third of the emissions through their statutory and discretionary public services. And again, a lot of that requires engagement with local stakeholders, and that's the leadership role that the public sector can play, really linking a lot of the things that we're collecting taxes to solve, and showing people, the taxpayers, okay, these are sort of the results, and we're doing it in sort of a non-political, unbiased way, so that you can actually see how tax funds are sort of helping address these global challenges.
Thank you. So, Nina, in public sector sustainability reporting, Time to Step It Up, it discusses the need for a centralized and standardized method of sustainability reporting for the public sector. What is currently in place at the moment in terms of public sector sustainability reporting? And what does our new report recommend exactly?
Well, Chantal, to be honest, we are moving into a disrupted future, and there are a lot of unknowns. And no matter who and where we are, it is very likely that the climate crisis, it's affecting us. So there is a need for an updated approach, one that, of course, still ensures that we keep on top of the figures, but also that we focus on the value of the non-financial drivers, and recognition that the value of long-term impact rather than short-term gain should actually be the new normal, because business as usual, it's no longer a sustainable option if we want to ensure the futures of our children, our grandchildren, and indeed our own. So sustainability reporting, that's of course the act of disclosing an organization's sustainability-related impact. And when you have this knowledge at hand, the organization can better understand what its impact actually is, and that's also where it needs to improve. It also makes it possible to benchmark, which provides a bigger picture of the impact that the public sector has on the environment and as a whole. So the current state of public sector sustainability reporting guidance and framework, it's rather confusing. And as I mentioned previously, there is a multitude of guidelines and requirements that have been developed for specific organizations, for subsectors, and also local government within the public sector. And this sort of patchwork of standards, it's inefficient and it's inconsistent. So really, no wonder that the public sector is lagging behind the private sector. So in our report, we examine closely some of the barriers to widespread adoption of sustainability reporting. And we advocate for using frameworks and standards that already exist and that are, of course, relevant and useful to the public sector's very unique needs, rather than trying to develop and adopt new ones, because that is going to, in turn, create delays and resource pressures, of course. So the report, it's aimed at preparers of sustainability disclosures and reports, and also towards policymakers. And it sets out key steps to assist organizations in planning and preparing the report, and also in developing a strategy for further improvements in reporting by highlighting how reporting can actually encourage sustainable development thinking and action by supporting organizations to improve its sustainable decision making. In the end, that is actually the goal.
Thank you. And Jeff, in Public Financial Management Can Lead on Climate Change, the case for carbon pricing, you advocate for a new approach to tackling climate change. And in the report, you examine how we can put a value on our environmental impact. The report talks about the need to adopt a whole systems approach. Could you explain a bit more about what this is in relation to carbon pricing and what it would look like in practice?
Yes, the idea of putting a value on our negative actions, in this case, things that lead to additional carbon emissions, it's not something new, but the approach we're trying to take is to join up the dots. And you refer to this whole systems approach, which in essence tries to better understand actions that lead to reactions. So everything you do has a consequence. And so in public finances, in the public sector, we try to encourage decision making that recognizes that by trying to solve one problem, you don't want to create problems elsewhere. You don't want to create problems in other sectors, service areas, or in different places. So, for example, when it comes to carbon pricing and the environment, I'll give a couple of examples. One is around congestion charges. So I think a role that government can play is demonstrating the effectiveness of price-based incentives, such as congestion charges, and acknowledging that this type of charge can serve as a very important source of local revenue. And that in the UK, for example, is very much needed. We've had around 15 years since 2008, where a lot of the local government funding has been hollowed out, and congestion charges could be a solution to that. There's different ways of doing a congestion charge. For example, in London, there is a congestion charge that during the pandemic was amplified to prioritize essential travel. And so you can flex some of the prices that are... So for example, for the London congestion charge, it increased from £11.50 to £15 during the pandemic. It was a policy already in place, but they, by increasing the charge, it basically meant that only those people who really had to travel or were willing to pay the higher amount actually did. And that led to not only lower greenhouse gas emissions, but it also led to considerable increase in bus passenger traffic into central London by a magnitude of about up 40% in the first year of the launch. And so this is an example of how tweaking an existing price for carbon emissions can actually lead to not only increased revenue for a particular authority, in this case, London, but it also leads to shifts towards mass transit and also towards reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. There's other things like low emission zones, and these there's two variants of those. There's the ultra low emission zone and the regular low emission zones. And both of these schemes generate around £400 million a year in revenue, which then goes to support public transport upgrades elsewhere. One of the challenges that we're facing in the UK is around fuel duty, and this comes back to the whole system. We don't want to just be tackling something like carbon emissions. We also want to recognize that in doing so, the government generates a lot of revenue through taxes. And so fuel duty generates about £30 billion in the current year in revenue, which is almost 3% of tax receipts for the UK. And the government is going to need to think about what will replace fuel duty as more cars move towards electric vehicles. And so we know that there will be a ban in the UK on petrol vehicles from 2030. And so what will replace that revenue stream that central government has, that 30 billion? And so it needs to start, the government needs to start thinking. And one of the solutions is, again, around road pricing and how motorists can be incentivized not only to drive less, but to drive cleaner. And this comes back to that whole system approach of, okay, how can government continue to receive the much needed revenue streams that it's currently receiving, while at the same time incentivizing different types of behaviors and shifts in technology today. And these changes aren't just happening in the UK, obviously, and it's not limited just to driving, but this is just one example. And in places such as Plymouth, for example, they've been able to look at their nature-based assets, such as their green and blue spaces, to understand how policies can be used to address other challenges, for example, in mental health and local employment opportunities. So really having a view of near-term benefits, linking those with medium to longer term goals, is what the whole system approach tries to achieve.
Thank you. And then finally, for you both, what does a sustainable future look like to you?
Well, the sustainable future of humanity, that it's a difficult one because it's huge. But of course, we have to protect the environment, which will in turn ensure that we actually have an Earth for generations to come. Sustainability, of course, is very much a global challenge. But in order for us to actually go global, we have to break the action plan down into fragments and pieces, because it's really all of those actions that are part of the puzzle that forms the whole. And that, of course, means that collaboration is absolute key. So we must all work to establish those necessary linkages between stakeholders that can support that positive development on a much wider scale. In short, we need to ensure that we are, and as so many times before, I'm going to quote the UN now, meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. It's a great task, but one that's actually necessary in order for us to secure a sustainable future for ourselves and for generations to come. And personally, I'm very hopeful when it comes to what the future holds for humanity.
I would just echo much of what Nina has already said, which is a sustainable future needs to recognize the needs of people across place and time. And so it's recognizing that just because you may be in an area of high economic prosperity, that doesn't then mean that you don't consider the requirements for people further down the ladder, so to speak, who are industrializing. So in this context, it's not just within a country, but across different countries. And so that the pressure on the environment that comes from industrialization is something that we all have a stake in ensuring. And that, to me, is what makes sort of the future outlook one that requires everyone to coordinate their actions and their intentions in a way that that comes together in a holistic framework back to this whole system approach. One other point I would raise is just around making sure that we have structures in place that allow us to monitor and evaluate how we are going to create the sustainable future. It's not enough just to say that we aspire or we have ambitions to tackle this, that, or the other. We need to be able to have facilities in place that allow verification of environmental benefits and the delivery of those benefits, and also improve the readiness of alternative sources of capital to complement public finance portfolios. So it can't just be one or the other. There's a lot of focus in recent years around ESG and the private sector, but there needs to be a readiness for that to dovetail with what public finance practitioners are doing on the ground to ensure that we're speaking in one common language. And I think together, by working together across sectors and across places, we can hopefully build a more sustainable future that works for everyone.
Thank you both for appearing on this special sustainability edition of Sit for Speak.
Thanks, Chantal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Nina Johansson and Jeffrey Matsu discussing Sitfa's recently authored sustainability reports. Up next, we'll hear from Jonathan Woods.
So today I'm joined by Jonathan Woods from Cambridgeshire County Council. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us today. First of all, please could you introduce yourself and tell us about your training and career so far?
Hi, thanks for having me. So my name's Jonathan, and I currently work as a finance business partner at Cambridge County Council, as you say, and I'm working in adult social care, so particularly mental health services. So I started working at the council straight out of uni, where I studied natural sciences, which is sort of a mix of all the sciences. And initially, the job was a graduate scheme that sort of had rotating one-year placements while I was studying CIPFA. And I'm sort of happy to say that I qualified from CIPFA last summer, summer 2022.
Oh, perfect. Well done. Well done for qualifying. How did you find the training?
Yeah, it was good. I really liked the variety of it. It was so, yeah, it was really satisfying to get experience in a lot of different areas. And then when I was applying for jobs after the graduate scheme, I really had an awareness of what the different areas involved and what I would like to do in future. So, yeah, I was very happy to have done that scheme and I would speak very highly of it.
Oh, perfect. So during your education and training, did you cover sustainability in the public sector? And what did you learn from that if you did cover it?
So I sort of, during my education and training, I've sort of had two areas of input on this. So at university, I was lucky enough to be lectured by David McKay, who's written an excellent book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. And so he had obviously a lot of ideas on this topic and I generally agreed with them. And so he sort of, his main starting point was how an objection to politicians constantly talking about like vague adjectives rather than workable plans and numbers that add up properly. But yeah, so that was a really big influence on me and my thinking on this subject. And then when I was in CIPFA and doing CIPFA training, generally it came up in most topics. And so it was often it was often a side note on most topics, which I suppose is like sort of captures it. So to be honest, it was never the focus and it was never like this is the topic I'm revising for, but it was often there as a consideration. And yeah, there's good and bad to be said about that, I suppose.
Yeah.
I remember the most interesting bit for me was corporate ESG and how companies are sort of voluntarily reporting on environmental issues now. And that's just so fascinating to me that just the change in public opinion is, and from investors, and that pressure on companies is making them do things differently and just voluntarily report on their environmental impacts. And obviously there's a question about marking their own homework and whether the government needs to regulate that to make it more consistent. But in general, I think that's really positive. And indeed, the public sector could learn something from that.
Fantastic. So we talk about sustainability a lot these days. So when you talk about sustainability, what does it mean to you? And what would you say that you think are the most pressing issues?
So to me, sustainability is about leaving the best world we can for future generations. And so I guess living our lives and building society in such a way that we don't disadvantage them, and in fact, advantage them as much as we possibly can. So this, of course, does include environmental issues like maximizing biodiversity and minimizing pollution, but I also think it sort of, the concept demands to be thought about a bit more broadly. So ideally I would like to be leaving society to future generations that has good living standards and effective public services and plentiful employment and better technology. And so these issues need to be sort of considered in a more broad and balanced sense, I think, rather than getting tunnel visioned into just one thing, because I think too often society has quite polarized debates on this, and we have like someone just only focusing on environmental impact, and it's like, oh, nothing else matters. It's like, well, other things do matter. It matters if people can afford to heat their homes, and it matters if people can afford to eat, as we've seen in this cost of living crisis so recently. Energy prices rising dramatically has really bad effects on the majority of the population, and we can't afford to do that deliberately. So yeah, I think we need to have a very balanced approach to sustainability issues and genuinely try and build the best tomorrow we can across the board, rather than just thinking on one issue, as easy as it is to do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So have you found that sustainability has been on the agenda since you qualified and started working, or do you think it needs to be more widely discussed and worked on?
So it is discussed a lot. I have slight issue with, so often it's discussed and given like lip service, I would say, which in a way that doesn't lead to action, which slightly frustrates me, that we often have, I think particularly politicians, I've got to a point where they're very comfortable saying, yes, it's an emergency, and proceeding to do nothing about it. It's like, well, if you believe it's an emergency, surely a plan follows. And that's what's surprising to me. Like, I would much prefer that we had less extreme language and more actual plans that work and were feasible to transition to a zero carbon future than what we've got, which is sort of the worst of all worlds. That, yeah, it's emergency this, but emergency we're not responding to? Very weird.
And so what would you say are the biggest challenges in the public sector that are preventing more of a push for climate action?
So I think a lot of it is about just short-term thinking, and that's largely because of like constrained financial resources. So particularly my organisation is pretty much year to year struggling to balance the budget. And so then you're having this very short term, like, what can we do to benefit next year? Like, and it's unfortunate that that does preclude more long-term thinking on sustainability grounds. And so we tend to be mostly focusing on very short-term issues. And so I think, yeah, if we were in a position where financial resources were less constrained, then we could probably make more sustainable choices. I think that's sort of just true across the board for individuals as well. Like, I think when during this cost of living crisis, I think people are less open to hearing about ways they could be living their lives to have less environmental impact. And I think they're far more likely to just make the choice that is easiest. So I do generally think it sort of links back to working for a more prosperous economy, not being contradictory to environmental good, and actually in many ways being helpful to each other.
Yeah, it's so true. I think even like on a personal level, when you're kind of buying food or, you know, buying household items, I tried to do a big push on sustainability at the beginning of this year. And I found that when you're trying to buy the sustainable or kind of less damaging option, it's really expensive. So it can be difficult to kind of think, well, what am I supposed to do when, you know, there's a cost of living crisis and everyone is kind of focused on those like urgent pressing issues, I suppose.
Yeah, that's so true, because it is just, it's just people, when they're in this cost of living crisis, can't make that choice. They're not in a position to make the choice to buy the more expensive, more environmentally friendly option. And I think it's just sort of like how the world is. Like, people are far more likely to chop down the local forest for firewood when they can't afford to heat their home another way. And as unrealistic as that picture is, it's sort of quite true. You see that people are very much more, they don't care about the environment as much when they're struggling to survive. I think it is, yeah, there's a lot of truth to that.
So as a public finance professional, what kind of impact do you think you and your colleagues can have on future generations?
So I think, as I sort of said earlier, there's a really interesting growing area about like environmental reporting and about quantifying the impact that companies and organisations are having on the environment. And I think that accountants have a big role to play in that. And so I'd be really interested. It's a very new area, but I would be interested to see if in the future our role becomes one of more green accounting and actually quantifying in an objective way various decisions at impact on the environment. So maybe in the future, an accountant would be involved in estimating, you know, the greenhouse gas contribution of a business case, and that would be considered along with its financial impacts. And I think that would be really positive, and we could get to a position where decisions are made with a much more rounded consideration of all the impacts. But yes, I don't quite know.
Do you think newly qualified accountant, as someone who's done the degree that you've done, do you think you're likely to kind of try and bring that as an issue in the future, like throughout your career?
Yeah, I do think so. I think I am quite, I'm quite passionate about particularly having concrete plans that do add up. And so I think particularly when people in meetings and whatnot do just say, oh, this new solar farm is going to generate a large amount of energy. It's like, how large? How many homes does it power? And people do occasionally say it, but it's just like, it is important that we actually put these numbers into context and actually work out in a very numerical way, how much of a contribution does this make to the future we're trying to build?
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Sit for Speaks.
You're very welcome. It's been great to be here.
That was Jonathan Woods from Cambridgeshire County Council. Up next, we'll hear from Peter Eckersley from Nottingham Trent University.
Hi, Peter, and welcome to this special sustainability edition of Sit for Speaks.
Hello. Yes, thank you for having me.
Would you like to start by telling us a little about yourself and your career to date?
Yeah, so I'm a senior research fellow in public policy and management at Nottingham Trent University. I'm also a research associate at the Leibniz Institute for Research on Society and Space in Erkner in Germany, near Berlin. And I'm also the managing editor of Local Government Studies Academic Journal. I have a specific focus on local government in my research and in a bit of my teaching. This kind of stems really from my background in local government, and also I worked for SIPFA for a long time. So after I graduated, I worked for Edinburgh City Council for a bit, and then I did my master's, then I worked for SIPFA for 10 years in mostly in kind of performance management and policy roles, not really in accounting. I'm not a qualified accountant, but I do obviously have a lot of interest in policy, in what governments, particularly local governments, try to do and how they try to achieve their objectives. So I worked for SIPFA for just over 10 years, and then I did a PhD in local climate policy. So I compared climate policy in the cities of Newcastle with its German twin town, Gelsenkirchen, looked at how decisions were made in those two cities around climate policy and how they were kind of implemented and the role of different actors within the locality in deciding on those things. And then since then, I've worked at various different universities in the UK, so Newcastle, York and Sheffield, before I came to Nottingham Trent 5 years ago. And also I started the job in ECNA, where I worked 10 hours a week, three and a half years ago now. And like I say, specific interest really in policy, how governments, particularly local governments, try to get things done.
So in terms of local government, sustainability, climate change, what's your impression of how we are generally doing as a country when it comes to these really important issues? And through your research, is there anything that you've learned that surprised you, whether in a good way or bad way?
I mean, the UK is one of the very few countries that actually managed to hit its targets in the Kyoto Protocol back in 1997. So basically, out of the developed countries, there's only the UK and Germany that managed to do that. So that was, you know, pretty impressive in the one sense. On the other hand, it was largely due in the UK's case to the fact that they closed all the coal mines, and therefore conversion from coal power stations and coal-fired electricity to gas-fired electricity back in those days. But it has continued to do well in terms of energy transitions and getting away from fossil fuels, particularly from coal. So very, very, very little of the UK's electricity is now coal generated, which does put it ahead of many other developed countries. But having said that, in some ways that's been almost kind of a function of economic and social change rather than necessarily from policy change. Although there was a decision to move towards gas and away from coal back in the 80s and the early 90s, this wasn't really done for environmental reasons. It was done because gas was cheaper. And you could say there was also a political will to kind of, you know, get rid of the coal industry as well back in those days. So in that sense, our progress on climate change has been helped by economic developments. Then things like the Climate Change Act in 2008 was really quite a world leading document. We were pretty much the first country in the world to set those things out in law in terms of, you know, legally binding reductions emissions. So in some areas, the UK has been very, very ambitious, very progressive, a leading country in terms of climate policy, particularly around energy. But then in others, if we think about particularly heat and also transport, other countries are ahead of the UK in those sectors. So, you know, if we think about the energy efficiency of UK housing stock, for example, is the lowest in Europe. And if we think about how heat is provided as well. So obviously most homes in the UK, most businesses are heated by gas in the UK. We haven't had the same kind of rollout of things like heat pumps as countries like France. We haven't got the same kind of infrastructure for local district heating networks as countries like Denmark, which can be much more energy efficient than distributed networks that we have here. And also in terms of the activities of government as well, that there hasn't been quite so much the same kind of active government response to some of these problems as there have been in other countries, and particularly in terms of how central government seeks to work with other agencies and local authorities to kind of, you know, join up activity, create a general, you know, mobilization of resources and actors to try and address this challenge. I mean, in terms of surprises, I think it's been quite surprising for me, pleasantly surprising in the last few years, how climate change and the environment has kind of gone up the political agenda. If we think back to kind of 5 years ago, it wasn't really a big issue. And then there was perhaps helped previously by the Paris Agreement and then also COP28 in Glasgow, but also things like the school strikes and a lot of kind of public protest and public mobilization of different people to actually to raise awareness of this issue and to try and encourage governments and industry to do things. I think, you know, if we look at some of the opinion polls nowadays, you know, climate change and the environment is one of the most important issues for people. And that wasn't the case 4 or 5 years ago. And actually, it's pretty much stayed at that level for quite some time now, even during the pandemic. in a way that, you know, that is surprising for me when you think about how action on climate change is. If people want to do something, it's not necessarily going to benefit them in the short term. It's much taking a much longer term perspective, both in terms of politicians and also businesses and also citizens. It's, you know, it's jam tomorrow. If you do something now, then things will be not so bad in the future. It's not an immediate satisfaction if you do something now that from tomorrow things will be better.
You're speaking about it's a long-term investment for benefits tomorrow rather than today. And in your previous answer, you mentioned that largely why the UK has been so good in its climate obligations is because we had to shut down all of our coal mines. But of course, recently we've seen in the news that the government has given the go-ahead for the first new coal mine in the UK in, I don't know how long, a generation. So is that sacrificing long-term ambitions for short-term gains? And is that coal mine going to, in your opinion, have a big negative impact on the UK's climate obligations?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the coal mine is a short-term decision. I'm still not convinced that it will open. I mean, I realise that the government has approved it, but there's all kinds of challenges to it. We've still not seen any kind of development on site in terms of actually setting up all of the infrastructure that would need to be there in order to get the coal out of the ground. And if we think about some of the public protests that have surrounded fracking in the past and that have surrounded, you know, other controversial energy sources, you know, or things like new roads development and this kind of thing, nuclear power stations, how long actually it takes to set up these new installations and then to actually get the coal out of the ground. I think I wouldn't be surprised that if indeed the coal mine is built, if indeed some coal is taken out of the ground, by the time that happens, I wouldn't be surprised if actually it ends up being too expensive that they can hardly sell any of it. So I wouldn't hold my breath that actually the coal mine will even happen. And I think which is another reason why I think it's short-sighted. Not just because it's because of the potential climate impact of it, but also because of the economic impact of it. And I think you can make a similar argument for lots of new oil and gas exploration, that eventually these will become stranded assets because they will become too expensive to extract the resources from the ground and to sell it, and because nobody will want to buy it because infrastructures and systems will have migrated so much towards renewable sources that actually there won't be the infrastructure to burn these things in order to generate the energy that people want. So I'm not holding my breath when it comes to the coal mine. It's obviously a bad thing if it does happen. As I say, I'm not necessarily expecting that it will.
So this episode is to celebrate SIPPA's latest report on public sector sustainability reporting. In it, we examine the state of public sector sustainability reporting and provide standards and frameworks to help public bodies disclose their environmental and sustainability related impacts. Currently, the public sector does lag far behind the private sector when it comes to sustainability reporting. What do we know about how much the public sector actually contributes to climate change? And what do you think is the public sector's carbon footprint like compared to the private sector?
I think it's probably fair to say that public sector organisations do lag behind particularly big private sector organisations. But actually, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think we need to think about actually what the organisations do as to how important it is that they provide sustainability reports on a regular basis. And I would always caution around sustainability reports as well as to what they contain and how much greenwashing there might be in there, because there's always the opportunity that particularly big private sector organisations have got that they only report on their own operation. Within kind of the whole sustainability accounting literature, there's the difference between different scopes of carbon emissions. And so there's what the organization does, where it buys its energy from, for example, what its kind of its upstream carbon emissions might be, so what is involved in procurement, the things that it buys, how carbon intensive those things might be, and then also its downstream activities, so what happens to what it produces after it leaves the factory gates or the office door or whatever. And I think with sustainability reporting there's a real temptation, particularly amongst some large companies, just to focus on what they do and ignore what happens to what they produce afterwards or where those things come from. And so we can see organizations like Shell and BP saying that they're carbon neutral because in their own activities they don't generate a net carbon emission to the atmosphere, But actually, of course, what they produce, as soon as that's burnt anywhere or manufactured into something, then that can be a highly carbon intensive process. And so I don't think that public sector organizations should get worried that they're lagging behind some of these other organizations, because I think some of these reports can be quite problematic, depending on what is included within those reports, what indicators they're using, how things are accounted for and calculated. I mean, the other thing is, it's very difficult to compare organization A with organization B. So BMW is very different from IKEA, which is very different from Shell or BP, which is very different from Google, which is very different from Westminster City Council, which is very different from the NHS. So they all do very different things, different levels of carbon intensity in their activities. Obviously, a manufacturing or fossil fuel company is very different to a local authority or to a central government department or public agency of some description. So generally speaking, public bodies are far less carbon intensive than a lot of private companies. And so I don't think that it's too much of a problem if the less carbon intensive organizations are less likely to produce sustainability reports, and not only in terms of their carbon impact, but other environmental and impacts that they might have as well. So in terms of what we might know about how much public bodies contribute to climate change. So the average UK council, for example, only contributes maybe about 2% of carbon emissions that are produced by the local area, which is, you know, a very tiny amount. And actually most city administrations or local government authorities tend to have more ambitious climate targets than they do for the general area. So in terms of climate neutrality, one thing that we've looked at cities both in the UK, but actually mostly in Germany, is looking at when they intend to become carbon neutral. And in pretty much every case, the city's got a much more stringent target for a climate neutral administration than it has for a kind of a climate neutral city. So the climate neutral administration, typically 2030, maybe 2035. Most cases, a climate neutral city might be at 2040 or 2050. I mean, that's partly because it's easier for the local authority to control its own operations, to decide where it buys things from, to decide how it delivers its services, than it is to kind of steer the behaviour of external actors to become more climate neutral. But I think also a part of it is the need to kind of, you know, for the local authority to be a role model in the community and say, well, look, we're doing this. We've got these ambitious targets. We've changed our procurement arrangements. We've changed our service delivery arrangements to become less environmentally harmful. So we think that you can do it as well. So yeah, I think there's those two drivers are leading towards it. But as I say, I think it's difficult to say that because, say, a city council is less likely to produce a sustainability report than a large manufacturer or, you know, a large multinational. I don't think that's necessarily a big problem. What local government can do doesn't just affect the carbon emissions of the local authority, but it can also influence the carbon emissions of the locality more widely. And so, you know, we can talk about corporate policies that the municipality should adopt in terms of maybe e-vehicles in the fleet, or, you know, changing procurement arrangements, or you know, solar panels on public buildings, more energy efficient assets, this kind of thing. But then we can also talk about the public policies that they might introduce that might change behaviour of local citizens and local businesses. So in the political science literature, I think there's a really interesting distinction between different types of policies that governments can introduce to try and change behaviour in different ways. And they all have their own drawbacks and their own benefits, depending on what they are. So we have, you know, kind of traditional regulatory policy where governments can say, or, you know, introduces, say, pedestrianization or low traffic neighborhoods or you know, this kind of thing, where actually it'll try and coerce organizations and businesses and citizens to behave differently through kind of legal mechanism. And planning is a classic example purely for local government in terms, you know, we'll only let you build there if you have these particular standards in terms of energy efficiency or solar panels on the roof, green roofs, you know, other kind of local sustainability initiatives like parks and this kind of thing. And then we have what they call distributed policy or redistributed policy, where government provides things, alternatives that people can choose. So public transport would be a classic example, or bike hire schemes, or more kind of recycling or, you know, waste management options for food waste, for example, things that which the state provides that enable people to select more climate friendly alternatives. And then we have informational policy, which is basically almost like advertising or marketing campaigns where governments will say, please, can you do this? Please, can you recycle? Please, can you leave the cart home, in order to try and persuade people? And that's not coercive in any way, but it tends to be much more popular because it's voluntary what people do. They feel like then the state isn't saying, you know, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that. So honestly, each of them have their own benefits and drawbacks, and some of them can be more effective than others. But it's sometimes useful to think about which type of policy might be most appropriate for the locality, because some of these will be more popular than others. Some will be easier to introduce than others. But then on the other hand, some of them might be more effective in terms of reducing carbon emissions or generally improving the environment. So, I mean, that's something that I've been quite interested in the past and I hope to take forward in future research as well.
Finally, from all of your research and experiences, do you have any particularly good examples of climate change initiatives in communities or elsewhere that public sector and local government could learn from?
I have a few, yeah. I mean, I think there were both what we might call corporate policies, so what the organisation is doing internally, particularly in terms of procurement. There's quite a lot of growing number of studies looking at how the extent to which local government in particular might be adopting more sustainable procurement practices. And there's been legislative changes in that in recent years as well, to try and make it easier for public bodies, not just to consider how much something costs when they buy it, but also the other implications of buying from a particular supplier or buying a particular good or service from that supplier. There've also been some kind of internal changes that some councils have adopted as well. So they've, for example, some councils have kind of set up a specific unit that just looks at climate policy in their locality and may report directly to the leader or the mayor or the chief executive. And it isn't, you know, kind of just hidden away in, say, in the environmental services department beforehand. That might give it a higher profile and make it easier to get things approved that they want to do. Some councils have set up kind of a climate advisory boards or committees that don't just involve officials and don't just involve elected members, but also members of the community. So, you know, local pressure groups, scientists, other kind of local experts in this area that can provide advice on might be appropriate for the local area. One thing that we've found in Germany that some cities have done is they've introduced kind of checklists. So when a council decides to invest in something or decides on a new project, it has to kind of go through an additional process that ensures that it won't have a adverse effect on the environment. So in terms of climate adaptation, this can be quite important. For example, if a new building is going to be put up, actually, what might be the implications for flood risk in the area? Or what might be the implications if you don't put solar panels on it in terms of, you know, climate carbon emissions that the council could save, or energy the council could generate as a result of the new building? One thing I've come across in Oslo, for example, is the idea of carbon budgeting. So they have a similar process for in terms of approving new financial spending, that it has to go through a similar process in terms of what will its impact be on the city's carbon budget. So the city has set out how much carbon it wants to emit over the next 5 years. And each department is then allocated a proportion of that. And each of its activities are then measured in terms of how much carbon they would generate or how much carbon they would save. And they are then approved or rejected through a normal kind of decision-making process.
Right, Peter, thank you for your insights on this incredibly important topic, which is only going to get more and more relevant as the years tick on. Thank you for appearing on this special edition of SIPFA Speaks.
Okay, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Peter Eckersley from Nottingham Trent University. That's all we've got time for. We really hope you've enjoyed this sustainability special episode of SIPFA Speaks. We'll be back next month with another episode, but until then, you can follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode. Previous episodes of SIPFA Speaks can be found on SIPFA's website, where you can also find our new sustainability reports that we mentioned in today's episode. Thank you for listening and goodbye.